Good morning. May I please court?
It does. Go ahead.
Your Honors, the greatest enemy of a personal representative who stands to take from the estate is a creditor. The overwhelming temptation in those situations is for the personal representative to publish notice, the bare minimum required by statute, and then to sit back and wait and hope no one shows up. Well, that's a practice that causes several groups of people in society to be particularly vulnerable, children in particular. For it is children who cannot come into court on their own accord. They cannot hire their own attorney. They cannot file their own lawsuit. They cannot prosecute or defend any claims. They have to rely on other people to do it.
What happens if notice was given to the children? Does that satisfy it, since they can't take action on their own?
No, it doesn't.
Does the personal representative have to go forward and have a representative of the children appointed every time there are potential creditors who are minors?
Yes, Your Honor. I believe that would be the proper procedure. And my authority for that is a United States Supreme Court case, Covey versus Summers, where that involved an incapacitated adult. I cited it in my brief. But the court in that case said that notice would need to be given to that person's guardian. So in the case of children, then yes, that.
And so how do we know what's a potential case? I mean, I know you think that was here, but if we adopt that, I mean, do you have to check somebody's driving record to see if they had a car accident? Do you have to see if they're current on their bills? There has to be some reasonable limit. What line would we draw?
Well, the standard is that the personal representative has to use reasonably diligent efforts to try to identify creditors. They can't just sit back and look at the face value of what they have before them. They have to make some sort of effort to go out and look. And if their investigation, if their reasonable investigation, would reveal somebody who may have a claim, they are required to give them actual notice. And under the Missouri statute, it's actual notice of the estate being opened, the time to file a claim, and the penalty for not filing a claim being forever barred. And so that's the notice that would need to be provided. In the fact that this case, the personal representative had handled the decedent's affairs for many years prior to his death. She knew about the children, my clients. She knew about how to get a hold of them. Those two things are not disputed in this case.
The question I originally asked was, if she had given notice to the mother, would that have satisfied the requirement?
I believe a natural guardian, yes, would satisfy the requirement. However, there's no evidence of that.
Because I think there was some indication maybe it was the father who was the person who, I don't want to mischaracterize, but was more responsible and came forward to protect their rights as opposed to the mother.
Well,
so
the mother,
my question is, if it's not a marital unit, is it sufficient to give it to one parent versus the other?
I believe the line would need to be drawn on custody. And the father did regain custody of the children before the death occurred of the decedent. And so he would have been the proper person to give notice to. There's no evidence that notice was given to mother or father in this case.
Now, the father was incarcerated during most of this period. And when he became aware that the decedent had passed away, he wasn't even sure there was a claim. He testified until he went to see a lawyer. So doesn't that show that the claim is really not ascertainable when there really was uncertainty even amongst the person who was asserting the claim, whether or not one even existed?
His testimony, the uncertainty you're referring to, I believe, is, what do I do now? I understand I just found out that the decedent died. What do I do now? Under normal circumstances, even if there had been no death, the children could have waited into adulthood, and given the fact this is a sexual abuse type of situation, that may be wise for a number of reasons, before pursuing their claims. And so as soon as he found out about the death, he contacted a lawyer. What do I do? He wasn't uncertain about the nature of the claim at all.
So what would be the effect of ruling in your favor on the thousands and thousands of closed estates where, who knows, there many of which would have had children who could now bring, 20 years later perhaps, bring a claim? And of course these states are all settled, the money's all distributed.
In this particular case, the claim was filed within a year after the death. And there are two particular, probate code has two limitations. There's the 473-360, which is the six-month limitation. And then, and that's the one that the United States Supreme Court's Pope case is concerned about. And then there's 473-444, which is which automatically closes all affairs of the estate within a year after the
one-year non-claim statute's been determined to be constitutional, correct? So,
pardon me?
Are the one-year statute has been determined to be constitutional, correct, with or without notice? So, this case really affects potentially cases within the period of 6 months and a year.
That's correct, Your Honor.
So the year cuts off everybody's claim, whether there was notice, published notice, actual notice, or no notice, for most types of claims, those that wouldn't be under some sort of disability.
Sure. That's the current state of the law, and that's not the case before this court. There may be some argument that a child or someone under a disability under that statute may be able to still file a claim, but here we were filed within a year. In fact, it was only a month after the 6 month.
Why wouldn't the same rationale that allows that prior cases have used to find that statute constitutional apply here?
That statute is what's determined as a self-executing statute of limitations, where it is triggered by the death of the decedent, and that's it.
No, I understand, but if you're saying it's unconstitutional, lack of due process to your clients, lack of notice, and therefore invalid under the 6 month, why wouldn't your argument apply equally to the 1 year non-claim? So we have to look at the ramifications of what you're asking us to hold, and can you give me a legally principled basis to distinguish between the two?
Yes, the 473-360, the 6 month statute, it has been determined that involves substantial state action, and that therefore it has constitutional implications, because there has to be the death and then the filing of a petition to open up an estate, issuance of letters, publication of notice, administration of claims. And so the United States Supreme Court said, well, that for due process purposes invokes substantial state action, and therefore we're concerned about the constitutionality. With the one-year statute for due process purposes, the issue there is that it's triggered not by state action or the involvement of the state, but it's triggered by the decedent's death. And so for due process purposes, that's the distinction. Thank now, the open courts provision that I have raised in this case as well, that would present stickier issues for 473-444, because in that situation, the courthouse doors would be closed not only to the presentation of the claim, but also any remedy. And okay. So that's where the distinction lies.
I'm concerned about broadening what's the definition of reasonably ascertainable by your position. How can this case be narrowly written so that we don't impose unreasonable expectations and duties upon personal representatives in the future?
What the case that I would point the court's attention to is an Alabama Supreme Court case called American Assurance versus Gaylord. And in that case, there had been a big auto accident. Several people had property damage and personal injury claims. Several years passed. A lot of things settled down. Things closed down. And the personal representative, one of the people responsible for the accident, died. And the personal representative was appointed. And she decided not to give actual notice to one of the other drivers. Well, it turned out the other driver had filed a workers' compensation claim. There was a subrogation lien established in relationship to that claim, and therefore the insurance company filed a claim after the six-month period had elapsed. The court in that case said the personal representative had enough notice, enough knowledge, to know that there may have been liability attaching to the decedent, that they should have gone out and given the other party's actual notice of the opening of the estate and the need to file a claim. Here we have a very similar situation. We have a personal representative who stands to inherit from the estate, who knows that there have been allegations of sexual abuse. Those allegations have been investigated by the state of Missouri, and some of which have been substantiated through that investigation. She knows those things. She knows about the claimants, and yet she chose not to give them actual notice. I don't think that takes it too far.
But your opponent argues that these DFS reports were ambiguous and contradictory.
It was incumbent on her at that point to ask more questions, to follow up on the state with the state if she had questions about the meaning of the letters that she had discovered, because it's her duty to use reasonably diligent efforts to identify potential claimants.
But you're saying it's only because she was aware of this prior finding, that there had been a prior finding that it was one of the claims was substantiated, that she had a duty?
Yes, I believe actually her knowledge of the allegations was sufficient for her to conclude that these children may have a claim against the decedent and they should be aware of it. Now, it's bolstered by the fact that the state of Missouri got involved, did an investigation, substantiated several of the findings, and she was aware of those things. And so the implications also go with regard to the open courts provision under the Missouri Constitution. We have a situation here where children are powerless to file their own claim and to do represent themselves on their behalf. And so what are they to do? In effect, all children are going to be barred from being able to come in and seek a remedy against a probate estate or a decedent that has a probate estate. And I think that violates the Missouri Constitution's open courts provision in addition to the due process clauses of this state's constitution and the United States Constitution.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Your Honors, may it please the court. Hotline calls or DFS investigations of child neglect or abuse most typically begin with a phone call, a hotline call. Those calls are made anonymously. There's no evidence in this case, one way or the other, how the DFS investigation back in 2006 began, but again, typically it's a hotline call. There was another apparent hotline call in 2008, and according to the exhibits that were admitted in the trial court, the 2008 allegation simply referred back to the 2006 allegation.
Well, opposing counsel's argument is that if you're aware of a potential personal injury claim, then you need to do something to protect the rights of the children, and that this was a potential claim and might turn out not to have any merit when further investigated, but someone should have been appointed to look into it.
Well, typically, DFS investigations, if they're substantiated and there's sufficient evidence, are turned over to the prosecuting attorney for prosecution.
Here, the first one was said to be substantiated but not prosecuted. So, but his point is, and can you address it where the line would go, should have been sufficient to at least put the personal rep on inquiry notice?
My client, the personal representative, did make inquiry into the validity of these claims. She spoke to the sheriff. She had an attorney representing the decedent at the time. Everyone, as she indicated or she testified, indicated there was nothing to this. It's not going to go anywhere. Nothing's going to happen. But again, typically the result of a substantiated investigation, if there's sufficient evidence, is that the findings are turned over to the prosecuting attorney and they make a decision about charging. The personal representative testified she was never aware, and she's a trained social worker, she was never aware of a DFS investigation regarding sexual misconduct toward a minor resulting in a civil case. That had never occurred to her.
Is it a subjective standard or an objective standard? You're saying she didn't understand that it might be a valid claim, but is that the standard that we look to as what she understood? Because reasonably diligent efforts and reasonably ascertainable, aren't those objective standards? It's a reasonable person, not what she thought?
I would agree. A reasonable person. There's no indication that the personal representative was not reasonable under these circumstances, because again, we don't even know who made these reports.
Well, but didn't she undertake to determine whether she thought they were meritorious, and that's not what the standard is?
Well, I would have to agree. It would be an objective standard.
And it's not whether the that's my question to you. Is she allowed to make a determination and decide herself that the claim isn't meritorious, or does the standard require that notice be given, as opposed to that there's a determination as to the merit before deciding whether or not to give notice?
Well, I don't think the statute requires notice to every conceivable creditor.
Right.
Only to reasonably ascertainable creditors.
But it doesn't require it to only give notice to meritorious claims.
No, not just to meritorious claims, to reasonably ascertainable creditors.
But you're saying this was so speculative once she looked into it that it didn't rise to the level of, she looked and found no reasonably ascertainable claim once she checked beyond the allegations?
Yes. She knew of these children. She knew of the DFS claim. But again, what their involvement was.
And you're saying a reasonable person in her situation would have come to that same conclusion and found there was no claim to be made?
Well, of course, everyone comes from a different background and has different experiences.
Well, because you're saying she misunderstood there couldn't be a civil claim, and that's a misunderstanding on her part, not an objectively reasonable evaluation of the
No,
claim.
I'm not saying she misunderstood there couldn't be a civil claim. Just in her experience, these types of cases did not result in civil claims.
And the judge, we're really reviewing the judge's decision. And the judge determined that this was not an ascertainable claim.
I think the language in the judgment was these were merely conjectural claims such that they were not entitled to actual notice.
And that's what we're reviewing.
Yes.
She was a social worker, and there was some allegations that the aunt of these children had told her that these allegations of abuse were false.
That's right. That was her testimony at the trial court.
Mr. Parman, do you agree with Mr. Creedy's analysis of the difference between the six-month statute and the one-year statute?
I hadn't thought about it before you brought that question up before, but I don't think, and I can see where it would be pigeonholed between those two because 444 has been upheld and 474-360 has not, but because of this court's ruling back in 1959, in Black versus City National Bank regarding special statutes of limitations, mm-hmm. I think this issue's already been decided as far as the open courts issue.
Yeah, I was talking about the U.S. constitutional issue or the due process issue. Do you agree that the difference between the self-executing and the non-self, that's been pretty well litigated in most of the courts?
Again, I hadn't considered it before. It wasn't discussed before. I don't think it was briefed. At first glance, I think I would agree with that, but I haven't had time to consider it. The other claim made by the appellants that these children are infants, and they're still infants, or at least they're not yet 18. I don't know how old they are now, but the fact that somehow makes the court unavailable to them, well, that's a fallacy. Here we are. They filed a claim. They were dismissed at trial court, and they've appealed it. They didn't get to do it on their own. One of their parents had to step forward and do it. But the fact is the court's open to them, just like it is to everyone else through their parents.
But it's open to them to lose. I mean, they don't get a chance to try their case. I mean, that's what they really want is to try their case and in trial court. You get to us crying, saying we don't have, procedurally we don't have a case, that's a lot different from saying they have an open court and they have a chance for to pursue their claim.
Well, procedurally they don't have a case because the claim was filed too late. Yeah.
But when you're saying they could bring a claim in some other way, what is that?
Well, there's an Eastern District case cited in my brief, Your Honor, and the appellant made mention of it in his reply brief, where the court dismissed a claim as not being timely filed, but allowed the circuit court action against the decedent to go on. Now, admittedly, there's no money at the end of the rainbow. There wasn't going to be a recovery.
What would be the point of that, then?
I don't know what the point would be, Your Honor, but the Eastern District made that decision. And again, it's cited in the brief. I don't see it right now.
Is it the Dane case?
Yeah,
I believe that's right.
I recall the argument. I just wasn't clear where the money would come from, but now I understand.
I'm not sure there would be.
Well, if there was a claim that had insurance, there may be a defendant ad litem available.
Yeah, that's a good point.
Although our cases have said in this kind of case that it's not injury, there's an exception for injury intended by the insured or something. Then we,
but that's a choice. They can bring their claim, or they can collect or not. They can still bring their claim.
Right. And the last point I want to make, Mr. Creedy was asked a question about his client's understanding of belief. His client testified at the in the trial court, and it's a vague statement. I didn't know it till he passed away, and only then did he call an attorney to ask what could be done. I'm not sure what that means, but it wasn't a situation where I think he would necessarily have done something if he had received notice of the opening of the estate. I think Your Honor's asked a good question. Who would that notice have been sent to? Because there was a change of custody during the course of this process. But again, I think the most important thing to remember here is we don't know if these kids or either of their parents were involved in the whatever started the DFS investigation. But the fact that the initial investigation was in 2006, that Mr. Austin died in 2009, and between that time, nothing had been done to pursue these claims, it was almost ancient
history. But
they
didn't need to. I mean, they had until the children reached the age of majority plus the statute if he hadn't died.
Except in a decedent's estate, yes.
Can you tell me the case? You said this court has ruled, previously ruled, that the open courts provision doesn't apply to protect a minor's rights under similar circumstance. Can you tell me the case that you're referring to?
Yes. Black versus City National Bank, 321 Southwest 2nd, 477. That was 1959. And that talks about a special statute of limitations, which this is. It's not found in Chapter 516. It's found in the probate code. And then Frazee versus Partney, which is 314 Southwest 2nd, 915, which is 1958. That case specifically says the infancy of the plaintiff does not change the law, and no other exceptions can be engrafted on the statute. The remedy here is legislative, not judicial, with all due respect. And unless there are other questions, I have nothing else.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Now, you're not saying that the claim, the open courts argument would say, well, they'd have a claim passed when it became reached majority. Well, you're not saying the claim is held open that long. It's limited because the defendant died.
Correct. It's limited because the defendant died. The open courts provision says that all courts shall be open and a certain remedy provided for all injuries. And so what we have here is a situation where this court has said that any barrier to a person's ability to pursue a remedy is to be judged by whether it's arbitrary or unreasonable. And here we're saying because a minor cannot, unless a parent acts for them, which finally happened in this case, cannot bring their own claims, that is unreasonable. Now,
medical malpractice, statute of limitations, we have lots of statute. You're saying we have to measure that by whether they're arbitrary, whether you have a 2-year statute or a 3-year statute. Why is that arbitrary or unreasonable? I mean, we have statute of limitations on everything.
Well, correct. But this court has a couple of cases, the Schumer case versus the city of Perryville, that addressed a situation where the notice requirement to a municipality when you're injured on public property is supposed to be given within 90 days or so. And this court said, no, not for a minor. It's unreasonable. You can't do that for minors. And then later in Strahler versus St. Luke's Hospital, a medical malpractice case, the legislature had limited the statute of limitations for minors to 2 years, just like adults, and this court said, no, you can't do that for minors because they are helpless to pursue their own claims. They are at the mercy of or totally dependent on the parents to be able to pursue a claim. And sometimes parents are good and do that, and sometimes parents don't do that. And this case is a good example of that. It's a broken home, That's
a common law without the statute, would there have been any claim against the estate?
for...
After the person died, could the children, absent the statute, would... I mean, is this a statutorily created remedy, or is it a common law?
It's a common law remedy. It arises out of assault and battery. And so I assume...
And a common law without the statute, could this have been brought after the decedent died?
I do not know if this was particularly subject to the survival statute. I just don't know that, Your Honor.
I know we're looking at this as under a reasonable person standard, but considering the respondent was a social worker and more familiar with this field than perhaps other people, she testified that she didn't think in her experience she'd ever seen an abuse or neglect case result in a civil lawsuit. Is there any evidence in the record on how frequent or how common abuse and neglect cases later turn into claims for a civil suit?
No, there's not, Your Honor, but let me address that issue. The fact that a civil suit could arise from those sort of allegations should not come as a surprise to her. And I'd point the court's attention to the Kansas case of the estate of Pennington and then back to the Alabama case of Gaylor. And in both of those cases, the personal representative decided on their own that there was no merit to the claim and therefore no notice needed to be given. The courts in both cases said, no, you are not the independent arbiter of these cases. These people have a right to be able to present their claims. Whether they ultimately prevail or fail is another question. They have the right to be able to pursue the claims, and therefore that should go forward. So she was not the independent arbiter.
Well, would we have to overrule Wyatt to rule in favor of your clients?
I don't believe so, and I recall reading that case.
Wyatt's the case your opponent referred to that was a wrongful death case where the court found that infancy didn't preclude the operation of statute of limitations.
I do not believe that case, and in recalling that case, I do not believe it addressed the open courts provision head on. And I believe it preceded both Strahler and Schumer, which are cases that did say open courts is implicated when you have a statute of limitations that cuts off a minor's claim before they're adults.
Thank you.
So for these reasons, I'd ask that the court reverse the judgment.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.